Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, actress and author Melanie Chardoff talks about the phenomenon of celebrity.
Between the time I had that trench coat on and flat shoes and then ducked into a souvenir shop to put on my green crocodile high heels and take off my trench coat, I became, you know, glamorous. It was just an easy move. I'm sure you've done it. And then I puffed out my chest and I strided onto the red carpet. And then suddenly I was famous. So I went from, you know, changing clothes in a souvenir shop to becoming famous. And flashbulbs and paparazzi calling for me to aim my famous face at them. And Melanie over here, Melanie over here, Melanie over here. All the way in, and I was startled.
Today on the show, actress Melanie Chardoff talks about the phenomenon of celebrity and her new book, Odd Woman Out. Stay close.
Hey, my name is Melanie Chardoff, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. Now, I hope you guys had a chance to listen to actress Mary Kennedy last week. Mary Kennedy, Melanie, is this fabulous actress who just landed this great role in the show Shameless. I don't know if you watched Shameless with Bill Macy. Do you watch it?
No, I haven't watched it. That's on one of my shouldn't have missed. Is it still available?
Yeah, it's still on. It's so funny. Mary was just on season 7, and the premise of the show, like the first 6 seasons, is it's about this family that they're all just really horrible people. And in fact, they're so horrible that at the end of the 6th season, the whole family throws the father, Bill Macy, off a bridge and they try to kill him, right? I mean, it's dark comedy. So at the opening of season 7, Bill Macy now is in the hospital. He didn't die. And he decides he's going to get a whole new family. And so, you know, one of his children's name is Fiona. And in the first 6 seasons, it was Emmy Rossum, who's just this incredibly beautiful actress. And then in season 7, he decides to get a new family, like I said, and he chooses the new Fiona, which is the name of the girl. He chooses Mary Kennedy, and she's in a homeless shelter, and she's like a broken down prostitute. And anyway, Mary Kennedy, wow, she got the role of a lifetime. And she's on the show last week talking about how she was a roadie in her mother's band growing up. How cool is that?
Wonderful. What a learning curve.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So she's like 15, 16, 17, pretending like she's the manager of her mother's band, The Mood Swings. That was the name of her mom's band. And they're going motel to motel. And anyway, it's a great story, you guys. So go back and listen to Mary Kennedy last week. But not today. Not today, because today I'm here with another fabulous actress. Her name is Melanie Chardoff. And I just finished your book, Melanie, Odd Woman Out.
Good girl.
It's so good. Really. Oh my gosh, Melanie, you. Well, the book is good two reasons. Number one, you have so much experience in acting to back up what you're talking about in this book. I mean, you are an actress of all actresses because you lived through, you know, acting and television in the 70s. And so.
And Broadway.
Yes, of course. And Broadway. So you're like done the stage and the screen. Yeah. You talk about the Broadway show that you were in. The first one, the space one, the Galactica one.
Yes. What a disaster that was.
That is so funny. You paint such an incredible picture of the ridiculousness of that show, but it reminds me of how then they've done shows like this have been done on Broadway before where they, you know, it's like an interplanetary thing. And like, remember Starlight Express? And then there's like a roller skating rink around.
And then Spider-Man was the most recent example of the dehumanization that they'll put actors through for a special effect. And that was what I experienced.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, it's so dehumanizing.
Yeah, no kidding. So you were on this crazy set and the people are getting hurt. Somebody got like metal poisoning from the paint that they had to put on their body.
The silver body makeup. Yes, yes. We were all stained for months. I had blue under my arms and in my earlobes. It would not go away.
And what was that?
But we had taken hazard pay. It was dye. We were all on different planets. We were all from different planets and we were rebels that escaped Earth that was now all blue people. This is well before Blue Man Group, and I was one of the blue people. Then they spray painted me yellow so I would be green in the second scene, and I had been a rebel. I was a rebel who came to this new planet called Ithaca, where we weren't controlled by Earth. And it was a fun idea, but the problem was that the story was so obscured by the very metaphoric lyrics that people couldn't follow the story, which is really very simple. A liberated woman seduces a man who's wearing a control hat and is controlled from another planet and gets him to feel his individuality and fall in love with her and make babies.
I mean, Melanie, like, I know that the idea of theater is like, you know, the pretend. I get that. And at the end of the day, you sound like it's saying, you're telling me the same story. You know, the man and the woman meet no matter where and when, and they have a family. Yeah. So it's like a very typical boy meets girl story. But it's like,
instead of being meet cute, this was meet technological and electronic way in advance of this whole movement, because we had like sextraphonic sound, meaning there were six sound sources that were mic'd around the stage. So the audience really felt like this show was in their bodies.
Oh, basically, my gosh.
Their bodies were used as speakers. And we were all flying and we were on trampolines, which made it look like we were jumping weightlessly from one crater to another inset on the stage. So it was trippy, had a lot of great ideas. They just didn't gel into a compelling story.
Well, but also, you know, you're not, you guys aren't stunt workers. You're not stunt people.
No, we took hazard pay, which meant that we knew we were at risk. We were paid a little extra to keep our mouths shut. And, you know, we all were put in jeopardy, more and more jeopardy as weeks went on and the producers got more desperate.
Well, you're not Cirque du Soleil. It's just ridiculous that you guys are doing
that. No, they wanted real people. No, you know how they want real people.
Sure, sure,
sure. Just happened to be able to jump on trampolines and
sure.
Sing while flying.
Yeah. Well, your book is tremendous because it really does go through the behind the scenes look at so much production, whether it's stage or television. You've done so much work. And so the book really shines through. And today you bring forth the topic, the phenomenon of celebrity. And I know that it is a phenomenon because, you know, I mean, I've lived in LA now for 24 years and I've met all kinds of people and I am so assimilated with it now. It would never occur to me to like completely like wig out with somebody. I don't know how to say it. Like, it wouldn't occur to me to go crazy over anybody because I know they go to the bathroom and I know they need a drink of water and we're all the same. Like, it doesn't.
Yeah, I don't go to the bathroom. All right. Yeah, right. We all are human beings through this phenomenon of facial recognition due to a lot of camera exposure. You seem to become a more important person, a more revealed person. You seem to be known by millions of people whom you don't know. And it's a strange imbalance to experience. I was on this show called Fridays, which was similar to Saturday Night Live. And within weeks, the entire cast went from complete unknowns to celebrity. And it was a strange phenomenon where fan mail started rolling in and paparazzi started assembling at the studio and fans started clamoring for signatures, you know, like we'd hold a pen and we'd put ink on paper with our signatures and that would flip them out and it would be something they could sell to other people. It was like every aspect of our lives became fodder for media and press. And as a small town girl who just loved acting and got into this by happenstance, sort of, just from an audition, it was really estranging. You know, I felt strange. People who knew me now looked at me with a glaze over me. My own mother didn't look directly at me since then.
That is so crazy.
I know.
That your own mother. That's wild. Now, I can't wait to hear the whole story you're going to tell us in a minute here. But I do find it just as odd as like somebody might see somebody, like if they saw John Hamm or an actor that they loved, and how, like you're saying, they get that glaze over their face and they're not connecting to you as a person to person. But now I can see how that is just as crazy as how I feel about like that they're doing that at all. Like, in other words, it's like crazy meets crazy. Like when you are the celebrity, you're looking at them like, why are you looking at me like that? So like nobody's connecting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's a definite disconnect. Unless somebody can get down to when you played such and such a role, I felt I was you. I was moved by you. I went into that story with you. I identified with you. That's the aspect of fame and visibility that I really liked. I would call a 1-800 number after I got so-called famous. And the person would say, oh, I saw you do such and such last night. God, that was fun. And you made me laugh. I really needed to laugh. And then that was the great part of it. Just a great part.
Wait, you're saying that you would call like the phone company or whoever you have to deal with that day. And they would say your name and you would say Melanie Chartoff. And then they would say, wait, who? Like that?
Yeah. Yeah. They still ask me if I'm the Melanie Chartoff. And as far as I know, no other has reared her head yet. But yes, I am the Melanie Chartoff of stage, screen, and voice fame. But anyway, the phenomenon of fame coming on, and I had it for like 25 years where I was written up and on the talk shows, and I was high visibility in a lot of different series, sitcoms, and such. And then it starts to go away, you're confused. Because people don't, like, they look right past you, or they look to the famous person to your right. You start to lose that. And then it feels like worse than if you had never been famous, because it really feels like you're invisible and negligible.
Wow.
So coming on and going off. Yeah, it's very strange.
Yeah, it's very interesting because it's very personal. Like, it's hard to just say, well, you know how it is. That's just because you see the big picture and you see what fame is and you see how, like, Jennifer Aniston was in and then she's out and then it happens and it doesn't. But we all know she's a regular girl. So, yeah. Like, you can say that, I know, but to live it must be very different. I have not experienced this whatsoever. But I'm saying, like, to you, you might think you understand it, but then when it happens to you, how could you not feel personal about it?
Yeah, it's very personal. I had experienced it at close range vicariously through my friend Betty Buckley, who I knew for many years in New York, a wonderful singer, performer, powerhouse actress. And she was on Eight Is Enough. So she came out here and was working for ABC before I was. And I saw what it did to her, the phenomenon of all that sudden money and all that sudden exposure and controversy. She replaced someone who had passed away on the show, who was much beloved. So she was fighting for her audience. She was trying to get them to accept her as the new mom on Eight Is Enough. And we lived at the Chateau Marmont together. And I just saw what she was going through. She lost a grip. She lost grip with her family. She lost contact with people.
Really?
Yeah, because she was so, it's like an out-of-body state.
But wait a second. Remind me on the show, did they just replace her like the lady never died? Or did they say
no,
on the show?
No, the lady, Michael Learned, passed away. And mm-hmm. they cast her immediately to replace Michael Learned to be married to a man named Dick Van Dyke, who was the star of Eight Is
No,
Enough.
Dick Van Patten. Dick Van Patten.
Dick Van Patten. Oh, my God. Thank you. They're all interchangeable, these famous people. They're all interchangeable.
No kidding. No, but no, I remember this specifically because it was one of my favorite shows growing up. It was one of the shows our whole family watched. And I remember this happening, but just tell me real quick. So when Betty Buckley stepped in, she just played the same wife that Dick Van Patten always had.
Well, I think that she actually, I think they did work into the storyline. I'm sorry, I didn't watch it that much. I think that he remarried.
Okay.
That the wife died and he remarried.
Sure. First of all, Betty Buckley, one of the most talented women, hands down, in the world.
Thank you. Yeah.
And second of all, when you write in the book about going to see her perform in Cats, that must have been so flipping magical. Seriously.
It was because, first of all, because I was getting famous myself, and Mikhail Mikhrishnikov and Neil Simon and everybody was saying hello to me like I was belonging there, not just some imposter. And then my girlfriend was just blowing us away in her rendition of Memory, which is a classic, on the stage.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, it's a complete classic. Isn't Betty Buckley's on the original cast album,
yes,
isn't she?
Yes. And they play her at parades, Amazing. And they play her at New Year's Eve. And, she's a classic, one of those classic songs.
So we're going to get to your story in a second. But let me just walk me through a night like that. When you're in New York, you're already pretty famous yourself. You're going to go see this premiere with your friend in it, or even if it's not the premiere. And you know a lot of famous people are going to be there. You have fantastic seats. What are you wearing?
I was wearing a trench coat.
That's what you have on the front of the book.
On the cover of the book. And between the time I had that trench coat on and flat shoes and then ducked into a souvenir shop to put on my green crocodile high heels and take off my trench coat, I became, glamorous. It was just an easy move. I'm sure you've done it. And then I puffed out my chest and I strided onto the red carpet. And then suddenly I was famous. So I went from, changing clothes in a souvenir shop to becoming famous, and flashbulbs and paparazzi calling for me to aim my famous face at them. And Melanie over here, Melanie over here, Melanie over here, all the way in. And I was startled. I mean, it was such a complete demarcation between off the red carpet and on the red carpet, in the trench coat, out of the trench coat. It was just a very strange phenomenon. And then walking in, being hailed by all these greats, and sitting next to Baryshnikov and Jessica Lange, and in back of Neil Simon and Marcia Mason, I was amongst them. And I was one of them, or so they thought.
No, you are. I think that is so exciting. And that image of you in the souvenir shop, I can practically see it because it's right there at the Chinese Theater. I used to sell Hollywood tours, in the little booth there. And aww. I know that souvenir shop, and you would just slip in, take the trench coat off. So now your beautiful dress is there. You're in your beautiful dress.
And I have the cleavage out.
Right. And you put on the shoes that are very, uncomfortable, obviously. And then you have to just kind of straighten up. Who's with you that you give your coat and stuff to?
My friend, Paul.
Right.
Who is still one of my dearest friends in the world. He helped me navigate the whole phenomenon of fame. He was a Ram Dass aficionado. He was a partner with Ram Dass in creating the prison ashram system.
Wow.
Where they would turn inmates who had a term of life in prison into an ashram retreat, teach them to meditate, teach them to forgive themselves. He's an idol of mine who was not famous, but in the hearts of millions who love him, he is.
Absolutely.
So he was my companion, my coat holder. He would give me a lipstick. He would give me a tissue to blot my lipstick. I mean, he was everything.
It's so funny how people don't realize that behind every actress, behind every red carpet walk, there's somebody holding the celebrity shit. You know what I mean? There's always somebody holding their stuff. And often
yes.
It's a boyfriend or a husband or a girlfriend or a wife, but often it's just a friend. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. He was my guy. And I got to take him to sit in the box at the Lakers games. I mean, he got a lot out of it.
It's such fun. Well, it is. And it's just a lot of fun. I think it's exciting.
It was.
And boy, oh boy, do you have the credits to show it. So we're going to get over to your story in just a second. But before we do, I did want to remind everybody that we're still playing Story Smash, the storytelling game show, every Friday night on Facebook and on YouTube Live. And catch the show, you guys, now, because we're going back to the Improv or maybe a different club soon enough. So you've got to catch these last shows here in the month of June. And then in July, we go back live. So please catch a show on Facebook or YouTube, 7 o'clock PM Pacific time every Friday night. We laugh our ass off. Melanie, you have to watch the show.
I've been on the show. I have won the show.
You've been on the show. I'm sorry.
I love it. It was like being at a great party with a bunch of stoned people. We were so silly.
I'm so sorry. I totally spaced that. Yes, you are wonderful on the show.
Very
wonderful.
Much. Thank you. Very
and when
much.
We go live, you have to come back. Oh, you'll be so much fun. Live is just.
I'd love to. I prefer it.
Good. Yeah, me too. Anyway, you guys, check out storysmashshow.com for any updated information and also check out storyworthypodcast.com. You know, all the websites are there. It's very exciting. So check it out. All right, you guys, she's here right now. Melanie Chartoff. You've heard her talking. You really are an amazing writer. Like I said, I just finished your book, Odd Woman Out. And, you know, you just know how to turn a phrase. For instance, you talk about how, you know, you don't want to be a mother and how you have so much to look forward to. And here's a short passage. You say, I'll have magazines, memberships, classes, charities, projects, a guppy, a puppy, no stretch marks, and a fertile imagination with too many ideas to nurture to even think about kids. I just thought that was so sweet. I mean, I'm a mom, but
I know
everybody has different choices. And I just love the idea because there is so much to do. I mean, there's so many choices, obviously.
Yes, clearly. I mean, a lot of my friends, when I was in my 30s, all my friends were dropping like flies, surrendering to men's seeds and their needs and having babies. And they were decorating their houses in pastel childproof rubber. And they were not able to see good films anymore. They were going to Disney films and to Disneyland. And, you know, our paths parted. It was very hard to suddenly realize, oh, I chose a different path than most of my friends. I didn't even notice it coming. I didn't notice I was even on that path until it was too late, really.
Yeah. It's really interesting. And for whatever reason, women didn't even really talk about it, it seems, until the last decade. You know, the people were even speaking up, like, there's different ways to live. You definitely don't have to be married to a man and live in the suburbs and have a certain amount of children. It just doesn't have to be that way.
Well, we're entering an era now, Christine, where so many of our cliches are going to fall away. For example, we're getting gender fluid. You know, nobody commits, even in childhood, to being one gender or another. Mm-hmm. We're getting racially fluid. I mean, we're mixing races. There's so many television shows and certainly commercials where you see mixed race couples. Mm-hmm. We're getting religionless. There are very few factions of really ardent fundamentalism left compared to the rest of the world.
Yeah, it's like if you're born into a family of a religion, you know, you might grow up that way, but I don't know who's choosing that now, especially, you know, you talk about in your book, The Scientology, and, you know, looking at all these different choices of religion. And, you know, when you're questioning, you could see how Scientology could suck you in. I mean, if you're clueless in the world, why not listen to those folks? So it's not that hard to, it's not that big of a jump to join a cult. It really isn't.
Yeah, you don't even know it's coming on. You don't even see it happening to yourself, just like fame. It's like, I didn't change at all, but suddenly I'm in this movement. I'm being put in a different position in the world that I hadn't seen coming. And I didn't even know I chose.
Yeah, but I think now with, in terms of religion, if you have HBO and you watch that documentary about Scientology, you know, you're going to wise up pretty quick, I think, you know, unless you're completely a dumbass. I mean, I just think there's less people that are falling into cults. They might be born into them. And I mean, religions too, but I don't know who's like actually going into it, like with logical mind anymore.
I don't know. I hope you're right.
Listen, I don't have to tell you, but I want to tell the audience that you have had a lot of intensive training, you know, in terms of acting. You were in the Stella Adler acting world for a long time, right?
Yeah, well, not enough time because I got hired to come out to do television right away. I was only with her a few years, but it was enough to have a great impact on my approach to working and to prepare me for television.
Like you mentioned, you were on the show Fridays, which was very much like a Saturday Night Live. I remember it well. I remember it very well. And you worked there alongside Larry David and Michael Richards. So,
yes.
Boy, talk about bright people right off the bat.
Oh, it was a very iconoclastic group of very smart, talented people. We all had our own ideas. But Michael was very loud, and he got a lot more attention than some of us. Larry wasn't the standout on that show, oddly. He hadn't found his misanthropic persona yet. You know, he's really developed this incredible persona
in
recent years.
Oh, beloved, he's the best.
Beloved curmudgeon. But back then, he was really a nice guy. And he still is a really nice guy.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, and he wrote very intelligent stuff. It wasn't stand-up worthy. Both Larry and I did stand-up at the Improv around the same time. We both had great premises, but we didn't have jokes, you know? We didn't have, like, jokes. We had character bits. Mm-hmm. And I think he and I both struggled with that form for a number of years until we were able to get into other things, into creating television or creating one-woman shows or books like I have.
Yeah, no doubt. And you've also had reoccurring roles on the Newhart show, which I loved. I've loved everything Bob Newhart has ever done.
He's good. Very understated.
I can't think of anything that ever bombed with him in it that I can possibly think of. He's just so consistently fantastic.
Yeah.
And then you, of course, were on Married with Children and Seinfeld a couple of times. You were also on Ally McBeal and Parker Lewis Can't Lose. On Parker Lewis Can't Lose, were you the principal?
Yes, I was a narcissistic Eva Perón of a principal. I was running a high school like it was a small South American country. I was definitely a villainess. It was really fun.
I must have been. I remember the shots of you like coming down the hallway. They would always show you like the camera must have been right on your face backing up. You know, I could see it on the dolly because you would come down the hallway and those kids would just like part like, you know, the wave would part when you came through. That was must have been
like the Red Sea. Yeah. It was really fun. But when I read the script, Christine, I knew it was going to be like shot like a science fiction movie because I had smoke coming out of my ears and a lot of shots. Sometimes my feet would be on fire. I mean, and these took a long time. These shots took a long time to set up. We had like 16, 17 hour days doing that show. But it was such a fun show. And the kids were great. The producers were great. It was a very functional family. You know, some shows and Broadway shows as well are dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. And this particular show is very functional. So we didn't mind staying up late.
That's so nice.
Staying up half the night.
Yeah, it was great. Amazing when the whole team is together on the same vision and wants to produce a really good project. Because that's when magic can happen, when everybody's agreeing.
Yeah. Yeah. I loved how they dressed me. Yeah. I love how they did the sets. I loved all the special effects.
That's great. That's great. And now you've written this book, like I said, Odd Woman Out. It's so good. It's a quick read, but also it's a deep read in that I've had to look up many words.
And I'm sorry.
I don't care. I'll admit it. I don't mind, but it's a smart book. And it really is a lot about Hollywood and a lot about behind the scenes stuff. So if you guys want to pick up Melanie's book, Odd Woman Out, you can find it over at her website, MelanieChartoff.com, but also at Amazon or at Barnes and Noble, or why not purchase it at SkylightBooks.com, your favorite neighborhood bookstore, wherever you live. That's my plug for the bookstore I work at. Anyway, all right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for the fabulous Melanie Chartoff.
So I was just a small town girl. I moved to New York because I was desperate to be an actress on Broadway. And I lived down the street from Yoko and the great John Lennon. And I saw them one night at the kiosk at the corner of 72nd and Broadway, where everybody bought their Sunday morning paper on Saturday night, picked up a Papaya King at the corner juice store. And I just stood next to them for a second and accidentally jostled them. And there was so much tension in me and them. I couldn't be myself. I actually put down the coins for the New York Times and didn't take it because I realized the phenomenon of fame, his fame had rocked me to my core. I didn't know what to say. I was blushing. My face was hot. I mean, I was just so, I saw what fame was. And then who knew that 8 years later when he was assassinated right on my street, that I would be on live television reading the words to Imagine aloud to like 5 million people. If anybody had said that to me at that moment, that you're going to be famous, Melanie, I would have said, you're fucked up. I mean, that's crazy. That's impossible. And I realized it was not so much fame or beauty or great wealth that moved me. It was talent. There had to be a whole load of talent underneath this fame for me to be touched or impressed or fazed. Presidents of big corporations, I'm sure they had a kind of talent, but it made me analyze, well, is talent just intelligence and business brilliance? To me, talent felt like a spiritual calling. It was something that came from beyond your own body. It was like channeled through you, and somehow you would get chosen to put across this unique point of view through your talent. And it also felt, in some cases, like desperation to be seen, to be heard, to be felt in a way that you might not have been felt in your family of origin. I think for me, it was both. I was desperate to get that kind of positive attention I did not get in my family. But I also had this extra gift, this kind of liquid thing that would just bubble up when I could get my father out of my face. It was a gift. And when I was true to that gift, I started getting a lot of jobs from auditions. I started getting a lot of attention for my stand-up act. When I was just grinding it out, it wasn't there. But when I keyed into this kind of mirthy, living liquidity, it just bubbled out. Now, of course, I knew it needed training. I knew it needed a lot of training because I was very misshapen. I think Stella Adler helped me a great deal. Ballet class helped me a lot, just teaching me how to carry myself and walk with dignity. I was kind of a schlepper. You know, I didn't really take an interest in my posture or my body English or my vocal projection. And I started studying all those things in New York, and it gave me a more charismatic stance. And I committed to that charismatic stance when I went on talk shows and was in the limelight a lot. It's an energetic stance. It's not something you can just slop through. In fact, all the Star, the National Star, the Inquirer, they take great glee in photographing stars when they're not at their most charismatic, when they're at their most quotidian, unattractive, no makeup, schleppy, pot belly, letting their body, you know, their bellies fall out. It's when they commit to holding their bellies in, putting on all the makeup, getting into uncomfortable garments, hydraulic bras, staggeringly high skyscraper, high heel stilettos, platforms. That is a real energetic commitment. If you want to be a famous person and have any longevity at that, you've got to stick to that program. You also now, you know, have to know how to twerk, which, you know, back in my generation, we didn't need to know how to twerk at will. But in any case, so I took singing lessons, I took dancing lessons. Back in my day, you had to be a triple threat to make it. You had to be a singer, dancer, and actor. And then improvisation sort of became an important arrow to have in your quiver. It was very important that you know how to improvise, ad lib, make up material on the spot. Because the lines that we were all reading at auditions were all the same. We were all reading the same scripts, but the behavior was completely improvisational. It's what shaped your personality, what made your interpretation different than other people's. So improvisation's always been a mainstay, and now it's a mainstay in my writing too. But in any case, as I got on this show Friday's late night comedy show on one of the big three networks, and we all began to get famous, I started to get invited on the Carson show and the Merv Griffin show.
First of all, when you're talking about taking all these classes and you're learning the disciplines, how old were you? 18, 19, 20?
I say 20. I did my first Broadway show when I was 22. And I had been studying with Stella Adler that year. I had to give it up and I lost my spot while I was on Broadway. But then I picked up again when I was like 23, 24, and I stuck with her until I got transported out to Los Angeles to test for shows.
Well, it's just like you're so fortunate, though. How did you survive the years in New York when you weren't working as much? You know, and when you were taking all these disciplines, who provided for you? How did you have that money to live there?
I was a production assistant at EUE Screen Gems. And I had a really good job there. It was very hard to give it up when I had to take a Broadway show because I knew I'd be back in insecurity land again. I also worked as a temp typist. I was a terrible, terrible typist. I'd say that my pages were crisp with whiteout. I mean, that's how many, if there were some correct letters and spaces, that was a miracle. I somehow struggled through and I started doing commercials and voiceovers for commercials. And that got me some money in the bank, you know, like McDonald's commercials paid really well.
That's amazing.
Ring around the collar.
It sounds like you really, you know, though you went out on your own and you made it happen. It doesn't sound like your parents paid your way or anything.
No, I didn't get any support from my family. My father, after a while, he realized I meant business. I think when he saw me on television on a soap opera, he said, oh, she's real now. She's doing the things she wants to do. She's making money. But I had so much disapproval from my father and so much discouragement growing up that I constantly had to get my father out of my face when the camera was on me. I would see my father staring at me and I had to say, fuck you, get out of my face, Dad. This is my time. Wow. And when I could clear him away, my talent was boundless. My mirth was easy.
Wow.
My tears were present.
That's amazing. I mean, that, no, I heard you say that, but I didn't know that all that was behind it. Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have a younger sister, yeah, who's in Brooklyn. She's a scene designer.
Was he as hard on her?
Yeah, but in a less confrontative way. Like, he didn't let her finish her degree at the University of Connecticut because she was getting B pluses instead of A's. He took that whole art director, scene designer course away from her. So she had to go work in a stationery store, marry to get out of the house. He really did her a disservice. I was angrier and tougher, and I think that anger really propelled me.
Wow.
And it still does. At some level, I'm still saying, see, see, see?
Yeah.
I'm trying to excel. I have a lot of self-discipline. It's so necessary.
Right. Well, it sure sounds like it with the ballet and everything. That's all discipline, all of that stuff. And so your dad is gone now.
He's gone. He passed at 73 years old. He didn't have a very comfortable life. He had a bad heart valve that he got in the service, actually. So he did not have a good quality of life. My mom's still alive. She's 97 in Hampton, Connecticut, thriving.
How fabulous is that? Good on her.
I know.
Okay, so then when you really started getting more jobs in New York, how did you come to Los Angeles?
Well, I had been asked to audition for the new Laugh-In. There was a producer named George Schlatter who produced the first Laugh-In, and he wanted a new Judy Carne and a new Goldie Hawn. So there were very few ingenue stand-ups at the time. It was mostly, you know, Elaine Boozler was terrific, but she was a real jokester, a monologist like the guys, a terrific writer. And there was Phyllis Diller, who was already on the late nights, and Joan Rivers. But I was like an ingenue. I wore a gown, you know, sometimes a tiara. I had a completely feminine approach, which was later adopted by Rita Rudner, actually, who became a very ladylike comedian later. But I was the only one doing that. But I was a curiosity, and I didn't get hired for Laugh-In, but I did get hired to come out and do various pilots. I was out here testing for Ralph Potsy and Maxine, which was a spinoff of Happy Days. I was on Wonder Woman. I mean, I was just coming out. They were flying me out for little things. And then I realized I would make so much more money here. And as much as I love my art, making money had its appeal because I was still living hand to mouth, job to job, you know.
Well, New York is just impossible.
It was very difficult to make a living there, much as I loved it, much as I still love what it was. So I came out here and I got a crummy little apartment. I kept my crummy little apartment in New York, which was just right on 72nd Street near where John Lennon passed. And I got a crummy little apartment right near the drama bookstore on Sunset Boulevard. So I felt like I was still in theater because the play script supplier was right nearby. And I started studying with a man named Harry Mastro George, who really helped me take down my theatrical projection to natural human size. Wonderful director on camera.
Wow.
And internalizing.
You're so lucky you had that person. Yeah.
He's still going. He's still working. Oh. He's amazing. But he only works by word of mouth or invitation. The right people seem to find him. Ray Liotta, Daryl Hannah, Elle Fanning. All of these people were in class with me. He's like a big secret.
Yeah, sure.
But his name is Harry Mastro George. You can find him online.
You're so lucky you had somebody to help you with that transition, because there's a lot of theater people here that can't get an agent. You know, they come from New York and they've done all this in New York, but they can't make that transition because camera is so different.
So different. And microphone is such an extreme close up. But I was lucky I made that. And so anyway, I was famous and I had to wear all these glamorous clothes and hold my belly in all the time and, you know, wear push-up bras and stuff like that. And I was a nervous wreck. I mean, I was playing the character that I played on Fridays, which was named for me, Melanie Chartoff. So this aspect of me, this limited aspect, the smooth, smart-ass, fast-talking woman, was the only thing famous. The rest of me was not famous. You know, the schleppy me was not famous. So I had to play that part all the time. And I played it while dating. And dating was very confusing because people would superimpose and endow me with all this power and glamour. and they wanted me to say funny things every moment. And of course I don't. So dating and really wanting love, being terribly lonely, famous, was very difficult. It was hard to find somebody that didn't see the glaze over me, that was equally famous, but not so spun out on their fame that they couldn't relate directly and connect. I found that dating other actors who were famous was very competitive. Inside every actor, there was an actress screaming to get all the attention. So it was very hard. And then I had fans wanting to date me. They give me their, you know, their possessions. They say, I own a farm. I own a brewery. You know, they like try to sell themselves to me. And I was in a Broadway show that moved out here called March of the Falsettos at the Huntington Hartford. And on opening night, a fan sent me a cage with a homing pigeon, a wheel of brie, and a Dom Perignon champagne, and asked if he could take me out after a matinee about 8 weeks hence. He said, if you say yes, put a yes note on the pigeon, homing pigeon's late, and send her home to me. And if it's a no, I understand, but I'll look forward to seeing you in the show. Well, I got so attached to this pigeon because she ate out of my hand. It was like something natural in this world of showbiz and fame and phenomenon. And so I kept the pigeon, and I would take her home to my apartment on Mondays when we had the day off, and got really attached to Midge. I called her Midge. Finally, after 5 weeks, he was coming the following week. I thought, I better send this pigeon back with my no. So I put the no on her leg. And I opened my dressing room window at Huntington Hartford, and I threw her up into the air, and her wings spread. She was so much bigger with her wings spread. I was so thrilled. And she flapped and she flapped and she flapped. And then suddenly she couldn't rise above the wind, and she gave up, tucked her wings close to her, and just plummeted like a stone and splatted on this Cadillac in the parking lot and died. And I felt I had to go on that night. And I felt like, oh my God, I've killed this beautiful animal that I adored. So I had to call the guy, you know. So I took his business card and I called him up and I said, I'm so terribly sorry, but Midge is no more. She's gone. She was a wonderful, wonderful pigeon. Everybody loved her here. And he said, well, what was your answer? And I lied and I said, it was yes. You know, let me take you out to dinner the day you come to the play. And I knew he would not be attractive, Christine, because attractive guys never work that hard at courtship. You know, they don't have to. So he shows up in this three-piece suit. He's all sunburned and ruddy. And, you know, we went out to the Brown Derby, the old Brown Derby on Vine. And it was just horrible. And I felt like I'm so not at home with my own self. You know, how will I ever find a romantic partner? Because I'm so estranged. Fame has estranged me. And these fans have estranged me from myself. But in any case, I also talk in the book about how going to unknown again is a very interesting phenomenon. After you've been famous and then people stop knowing your name and stop recognizing you and you're not getting on the tube as much, I started doing an animated series, a very successful animated series called Rugrats. Right. So I was known for this voice, but I was no longer known as myself. So, and anonymity came flooding back. And after having been recognized.
That's amazing, by the way. Yeah. Holy cow. That's great. Tell me a little bit more as a Rugrat guy.
As a Rugrat character, I looked nothing like the character who had like 3 points of hair on her head and she wore big glasses. And over the years that they animated me, over the 20 or so years that we did seasons, the character began to look more like me. She had my forehead. Her mouth moved the same way mine did. I mean, it was like we were merging, but I was recognized more as her than as me. And since I don't have that voice, you know, that little Dee Pickles voice on the rule, nobody recognized me anywhere. So suddenly a veil of invisibility came back over me. And I'd be at the improv club and I'd see somebody barreling toward me with their hand outstretched. And I'd think, who is this? Do I know this person? And they go right by me to some other comedian who is now having her turn in the limelight, you know? So it's been okay. I mean, I accept it. I understand it. There's a lot less pressure on me. Mm-hmm. I still love acting. I still love being on the chat shows. I still love talking to folks like you who I wouldn't get to talk to on a normal day. But it's different now. It's very different now. And I can rest on my laurels. And now I get to write and have so much more spare time. Instead of doing the heavy lifting that my body did on the stage, now my words do the heavy lifting for me of communicating ideas and talent and feelings. And I have no writer's block in sight. I just have so much to say Apparently.
That's so exciting. And let me ask you, how long did it take you to write Odd Woman Out?
Odd Woman Out, Exposure in Essays and Stories, was first a one-woman musical, which I performed. The Joshua Tree Comedy Festival optioned a one-woman musical from me, and I did that in 2016, 2017. And then I
could, amazing.
Yeah, so a lot of these stories had songs interspersed.
Who wrote the songs?
I wrote the lyrics. Wonderful songs like Fine Lines, Getting Famous, wonderful expressive songs with a guy named Doug Katsaras, who's in New York. He's a guy I've been writing with since we were like 20. He's a very gifted musician. He's kind of like a John Batiste. He can go in any direction musically.
Wow.
He can do hip hop, rock opera. He can do classic. He can do minuet. In any case, a literary agent came to see me and stayed and came backstage. And she said, this is a book. You should get rid of all these songs and write the book because these are important stories. Every single person needs to hear. Every lost woman or man needs to hear. Any gender needs to hear. And so she mentored me, got me started. And it took me about a year to put the stories together in an order that was cathartic and get my husband's permission to share the intimacies of our relationship, which led to my marriage at the age of 65 for the first time.
And that's at the very end of the book. Listen, Melanie, I see you on Broadway with this show. I mean, there's just no doubt about it to me.
Oh, thank you. Well, tell somebody. Tell somebody with big bucks.
But I'm serious. Melanie, you're such a wonderful talent, and the book is just fantastic. You've led an incredible life. People want to hear this stuff. It's funny. You go into some really funny behind-the-scenes details about, you know, the very unglamorous life as an actress. That's not what people see.
I also go into the kind of living with the patriarchy, Christine, at a time when we just didn't talk about it that much. All the all the slings and arrows of offense, all the humiliations of being felt up without your permission, all the power moves. That was an inner life that we didn't express in those days. We just let it roll off our backs, right?
Melanie, when I read the chapter about you getting groped by Ed Asner, my mouth just hung open. I was on an airplane and I was sitting next to my boyfriend and I said, look at this, because Ed Asner completely groped me and said inappropriate things. And that's like just 2 years ago.
Yep.
And I know he's done that to other women too.
Yeah. And,
You know,
we accept it because he's such a great man. He's such a great man and he's been a hero.
And he's old. He's old. He's over 90. Let it go. And we all have to laugh. Ha 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 ha. It's so funny, but it's not funny and it's super gross. And anyway, when I read about it in your book, it really, says something to me. Now, when I talk about Ed Asner and the fact that he did these things, I'm never talking about in a legal way or like an assault way. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that he's just not hip to that things have changed. Do you know what I mean? He's not hip to, you can't do that anymore, Ed. Like somebody should just tell him. I don't think he's because I think he's a very smart man and I think he's very intelligent, but it just shows his completely out of touch old generation, old man attitude that he can't fucking get it together to understand that is not what is happening anymore.
Well, I don't think he's out of touch. I think he feels entitled nonetheless. And, you know, just like George Bush in his wheelchair grabbing, you know, he called himself David Copperfield.
Ugh.
I don't know if you read that anecdote about the elder, the original George Bush. Yeah. So, I talk about it in the book.
Yeah, it's just so gross.
And this happens so much.
So much. Yeah. And you just have to laugh it off. Ha, ha, ha. But I will say that, like, I was in New York recently and, okay, now, sure, I'm getting older. But really, I heard no catcalls. I'm saying it as if they were me. No, but I mean, in other words, it was kind of like I am feeling a little more that people are more respectful. And I'm talking about men in their teens, 20s, 30s, 40s. Like I am feeling like things have changed. I am. I do feel hopeful.
Yeah.
But Ed Asner, just, you know, between me and you and my entire audience, which I think they already know this, the first thing he said to me, well, don't you have a nice rack? That's the first thing he said.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
it's so disrespectful. It's so disrespectful. What was the second thing?
And everybody has to say, and it's just, oh, it was just gross. It was just gross. But I mean, we got along, you know, nice guy, but I just hate that we all have to give that a pass just because he's a good actor. That's mm-hmm. frustrating.
Well, also, I mean, he's taken a stand for a lot of causes I believe in.
Of course.
He and Martin Sheen sat in. They were put in jail, you know, for causes I espouse. He is the president of SAG, got actors long. I mean, he's a heroic figure.
Now, I know. I'm just saying that somebody needs to tell him, hey, dude, that's not the way it is anymore. You just can't get away with that.
Well, I told it in my book. I did it in my book.
Yeah. Yeah. You did.
Yeah. Also, Henny Youngman, but he's dead.
Yeah. Well, Henny Youngman also, again, that, you know, you're talking about a different generation, and I don't know if they knew any better. They didn't know that the language could be so hurtful. I don't think they even, it didn't occur to them because nobody told them the words.
Yeah. I guess men don't realize when they grab you or they grab me in a very intimate, erogenous place, it reduces us to just an object. It reduces us to disrespectful, almost the level of a prostitute. Or a woman that's paid for sexual favors. It's so reductive and insulting and hurtful.
Yeah, it really is. On that note, well, listen, Melanie, I'm just so thrilled to know you now. I feel like we've become friends. I hope to actually meet you in person at some point.
Oh, imagine that.
I know, right? But you were so funny on Story Smash, and I really appreciate you coming on the game show as well. You're amazingly talented. Your book is phenomenal. Please, you guys, head over to MelanieChartoff.com. Check out everything she's doing. And then also, you can buy that book anywhere you buy your books, but do check out SkylightBooks.com. You know, do me a favor. Anyway, you guys, this has been so fun. Thank you so much, Melanie, for your time. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thank you.
All right, you guys, one more time on behalf of the very talented Melanie Chartoff, my name is Christine Blackburn saying, make it a story worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.